Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called A Union for Every Driver, Sectoral Bargaining Comes to the Rideshare Industry. We're very pleased to welcome our two speakers today, David Madlin and William Messenger. David Madlin is a senior fellow and the senior advisor to the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. William Messenger is the vice president and legal director of the National Right to Work Legal Defense and Education Foundation. Our moderator, Alex McDonald, is a shareholder and co-chair of the Workplace Policy Institute at Littler Mendelsohn. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Alex, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Now, thank you, Sarah. And I do want to thank our expert panel for appearing today. I'm really excited about this one, and I'm sure our audience is as eager as I am to move on and hear what they have to say. But before we throw it to the more open discussion, I think it might help folks to just set the table a little bit, talk about the genesis of this particular show. And as Sarah mentioned, and so today's topic of discussion generally is sectoral bargaining, or what's sometimes called broad-based bargaining. But specifically, the genesis is a pair of new laws that focus on the app-based rideshare industry. The first of these two laws was adopted in Massachusetts in 2024 by voter initiative, actually, question three. And then the second was adopted just this last session in California by the legislature. That was AB 1340. Now, I'm going to gloss over some of the differences a little bit because we could spend a lot of time on the differences of the mechanisms of these two laws, but they do both work in similar ways in broad terms. So I'm just going to lay out those broad terms to the extent we need to talk about the differences. We can get into that in the general discussion. But so broad strokes, what these two laws do is they erect a quote-unquote sectoral bargaining system for app-based rideshare drivers. But the system has some features that are different from what those of us who have practiced, traditional labor law for decades and decades might think that a law like this would function as. So the biggest difference is that these two laws divide up all rideshare drivers into what are effectively statewide election units at first, and then potentially bargaining units. They also create a new kind of infrastructure for organizing those units. So the first step is that the rideshare platform operators, your typical apps, or as the statutes call them, transportation network companies. These are, most people familiar with this. They're, the standard app-based rideshare companies. They have to first give certain information about the driver community to a state regulator, which collects the information and measures the size of the workforce, the volume of particular drivers, et cetera. And then that regulator can potentially give that information to a labor organization that wants to organize the workers. The way it works is the labor organization first has to petition the regulator, showing that it has a baseline level of interest among the drivers. I think in both statutes, the baseline interest is 5% of what the laws call active drivers. And that showing kicks off a streamlined organizing process which under either statute can ultimately result in an election or an automatic certification based on a minimum showing of support. I think in both, it's 25% for the automatic certification. But either way, once the labor organization is certified, either through an election or through this just gathering enough signatures, effectively electronic signatures, that enough drivers want the labor organization to represent them, it becomes the exclusive bargaining organization for all drivers in the state. So now you've got a statewide unit, which is different than the way the NLRA works, which is typically what we call enterprise bargaining, which is workplace by workplace bargaining. So now we've got one union representing all drivers in the state, and that union then has a statutory right to negotiate with all of the rideshare platform operators or transportation network companies, TNCs. And the bargaining subjects, again, there's differences between the two statutes, but generally, those subjects mirror the NLRA. We're mostly talking about compensation, scheduling, benefits, deactivations, or, you know, getting kicked off the platform, those kinds of things, disciplinary issues. But unlike the NLRA, once we get into this negotiation, there's no option for the employer equivalent here, the TNCs, to unilaterally implement their final best offer. So normally, under the NLRA's process, we negotiate. If we get to an impasse, we can't come to an agreement. The statute allows an employer to just implement its last best final offer. Here, what happens is we go to what's called interest arbitration. Which is different from what most people think of as arbitration, which is like, you know, resolving a dispute under a contract. This kind of arbitration is where an arbitrator, a third party, effectively helps the parties write a contract. There's a hearing, both parties put on evidence, the arbitrator ultimately comes up with terms. So already we're getting into a little bit more of a complicated process than we have under the NLRA, but even then we're not done. So now we've gone to interest arbitration. There's been a hearing. The arbitrator has written terms. Those terms then get sent to a public regulator. And that regulator looks at the terms, decides whether they meet the policies embedded in these statutes, mostly, you know, providing a minimum level of compensation for the drivers. And only then, if the public official approves, do we have terms that take effect? And they take effect statewide, even for every platform, every covered driver. This is effectively a statewide collective bargaining agreement. Now, again, that summary glosses over some details in the process, but I think that's enough to give us sort of a baseline understanding of what the structure is here. So I think now I'd like to start involving our panelists a little bit, starting with you, David. David, you've written a lot about broad-based bargaining or sectoral bargaining. Just what is your sense of why states are moving in this direction now? Why are we seeing these laws? What's driving this trend?
Thanks. Thanks for having me, and thanks for that really good introduction and overview of the laws. So I think there are a lot of things behind why states are doing this. The first is I talk about the general benefits of sectoral bargaining. I'll go into those. I think there's a lot of reasons economically that there's a good system of bargaining. There's also some details about the industry of rideshare and then the legal framework of rideshare that I think is prompting all of this. So the first is the general benefits. Why might we like to cover all workers doing a similar kind of job with a similar kind of contract as opposed to just an individual work site by work site level? Well, for where I sit, the biggest thing that leads to is that more workers get covered by a collective bargaining agreement. And that is a good thing in my view, because it means better jobs. It means higher wages, better benefits, greater protections, all of the kinds of things that collective bargaining agreements have that are an improvement upon what most workers are able to negotiate for on their own. And in this case, in rideshare, they can negotiate for anything on their own. It's either take it or leave it, basically. So you get the better benefit, better improvements for the workers. You also create a level playing field where a firm that is unionized is not at a economic disadvantage. They are on a same playing field as all the other firms. And that generally leads to productivity improvements because firms have to compete based on productivity, not on lowering their labor costs. Everyone has a similar plane. This has actually led to some level of conservative support for this kind of model. You can listen to sort of Orrin Cass and related ilk who will describe sort of some of the same kind of benefits I described. And especially they will highlight that in their view, this tends to be better than an alternative like government wage setting, strict, more pure minimum wage or et cetera kind of thing. Then I think you also get to the specifics of the rideshare industry. And why are we sort of starting with rideshare in this model? The first is that this is a particularly difficult industry in a lot of respects. First, for workers, it is sort of the hallmark of low standards. Wages are often in like well below whatever minimum wage there exists. One study suggested that their workers are getting paid about $6 an hour in California, where there are inferior regulations to set a much higher standard. And that counts for because the drivers are paying for the costs of cars, insurance, et cetera, but they're also not necessarily getting paid for their waiting time while they're trying to work. So you have low standards. And as I mentioned, sort of existing policies haven't necessarily improved these conditions. And just a couple more things on the sort of really low conditions. There's the threat that these drivers face of arbitrary deactivation with no way to challenge this. And that's seen by a lot of, more pro-worker sides as like, that's kind of unfair. They should at least be able to present their case, have some view that rather than an algorithm deciding. Also, the algorithm is deciding what they're getting paid. They oftentimes have a hard time knowing what they're actually going to be taking home when they're accepting a ride. So these challenges of the industry lead a lot of people to say we can do better, and this model presents that. We also, it's the other models, as I mentioned, aren't likely to work. So there's been efforts to raise minimum standards, several states. And yes, there's improved above they've improved standards slightly above where they were without the minimum wages. But ultimately, the studies suggest they are still getting very, very low standards. Then you have, what could they just unionize under a traditional model? Well, probably not for a lot of reasons. The one, they're probably excluded from, they're excluded from the NLRA, explicitly written out, but couldn't a state do a workplace by workplace organizing model? Well, it's pretty unlikely to work in a lot of respects. First, these workers work for multiple companies, typically almost simultaneously. They don't have a traditional work site, so the organizing process is very hard and different, and the turnover is incredibly high. All of these factors make the traditional work site by work siting model less likely to work. And then the last, and probably the most compelling, or the reason that's really focusing on rideshare, is that the legal regime is different because states have much more freedom to act. As your listeners are probably aware, the National Labor Relations Act has been interpreted to prevent lots of things that state and local governments could do to promote unions and collective bargaining. But unless and until the Trump administration and the Supreme Court says these drivers are employees, they are considered independent contractors under the NLRA and outside its jurisdiction, giving states more freedom to act. And so I think all this combination of some successful models with some benefits that it can provide to workers and to the industry, the legal regime, and then the lack of success of, or likely success of, other kinds of models.
That's great. And so, Bill, I was going to ask you the same question of what you think might be driving this. But David's also laid out what he sees as some of the benefits for workers. I know you represent workers. That's what National Right to Work does. Just wonder if you have any reactions to whether you see anything on the other side, or whether there are potential downsides for workers. What's your view?
I'm sure sort of a host of thoughts. But the first, I think, is what makes sectoral bargaining that we're talking about different than normal collective bargaining is that this sectoral bargaining results in a government order that sort of imposes wages, prices, working conditions across the board. So sort of the hallmark of collective bargaining under the National Labor Relations Act, besides it being employer by employer, is that the government doesn't actually impose any terms. The government requires bargaining, but ultimately the government doesn't require terms. It's not involved in setting the terms. And the end result is at least a partially voluntary private agreement or no agreement at all if the company and union, you know, can't come to an agreement on what the terms should be. With sectoral bargaining, what you're talking about, and you described the process in California, Massachusetts, is really just a process to set what will ultimately be a government order sort of regulating an entire industry, what wages it pays or prices it has, compensation, and other terms. So the whole thing Massachusetts and California set up, you know, as you described, is, you know, first you make the union the representative, and then they have to bargain over what the recommendation will be to a government official. And then if they can't agree to something, another government official comes in, an arbitrator, which is really a false term here, you know, dictates what the terms shall be. And then ultimately they make a recommendation to the government official, which is PERB in California, Secretary of Labor in Massachusetts, who then basically says, approves or disapproves it. And if it's approved, it becomes effectively a statewide law or regulation governing an entire industry. So what we're talking about here with sectoral bargaining isn't sort of a different kind of collective bargaining. It's just a sort of a process for central government planning. And central government planning, sort of the government setting wages and rates and the way, you know, a whole industry should work, you know, I think most economists agree is not a very good idea. It hasn't worked out very well. It has a host of downsides to it. And that's true no matter how it's done. So if you're against and don't think it's a good idea for some government agencies, say the Massachusetts Secretary of Labor, to just dictate how, you know, the entire rideshare industry should operate, then you shouldn't agree for sectoral bargaining, you know, to basically lead to that result of how the Secretary of Labor should ultimately do it. So I just think it sort of should be conceptualized in terms of what we're really looking at here with sectoral bargaining, which is ultimately a government regulation of an industry and how it works, and not true bargaining, which is done more voluntarily.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense. So, David, I think some of what the discussion is focused on here so far is really a predictive difference in what we might see produced through these systems, what the ultimate policy effects will be for workers. I know that you've written a lot about sectoral or broad-based systems in other countries. And I wonder just if you have any thoughts about what lessons we might be able to take from the experience in other countries and whether that could translate to what we should expect under these two new systems.
Got it. Yeah. So we were all familiar with the Wagner Act model, which really in international terms is kind of an outlier. Most of the rest of the world tends to, not everywhere, but generally they have more of a sectoral bargaining system. They achieve that through lots of different methods, but most places that have collective bargaining tend to do it at this higher level above the individual worksite. They also allow some worksite by worksite bargaining, but more of their bargaining is done at a broader level than the U.S. And I will say generally there's lots, you know, when I sort of cited the sort of good things about sectoral bargaining at the beginning, most of that is based on research around of countries around the world, particularly Europe, but also South America as well. And generally the way the world has moved over recent decades is that most of the world has pushed, sort of a neoliberal kind of economic policy that has done things to weaken unions, collective bargaining, and including sectoral bargaining. So generally, there's been this trend, even countries that have long established sectoral bargaining in Europe, et cetera, have generally, not always, moved a little bit away from this. Yet, I think the countries most like the U.S., the English-speaking folks of the world, the Britons, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, they had a host of policymakers there, especially pro-labor, but not exclusively, are increasingly recognizing the benefits of sectoral bargaining and are pushing more towards it. The most recent sort of example is Australia in, I think, 2023, So the history of Australia, they had a sectoral bargaining model for much of its history, led to relatively low levels of inequality, relatively high wages by international standards. Then in the 90s, they sort of got rid of it. They went to a more Wagner-Act style model and had lower union density, lower collective bargaining coverage, more stagnant wages, rising inequality. And just now in 2023, they passed some policies, including some that promote sectoral bargaining, and have seen greater collective bargaining coverage, some rising wage growth. So that's sort of the general, the closest analog I can think of is probably Australia, and that's what I would expect. But as you alluded, you know, or maybe you said directly, this is an experiment. We're kind of going to see how this actually operates in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. And Bill, I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the way that these systems work as being sort of a government-directed set of conditions as opposed to true bargaining. It makes me wonder, look, I know that you've litigated a lot of cases in the public sector. Because of the way that these statutes are set up, do you see any overlap between the experience that you've had in the public sector and whether any of the issues that you've dealt with in that sphere translates here, and whether that's informing any of your concerns about these laws?
Sure. There is some overlap with sectoral bargaining and public sector bargaining, but really sectoral bargaining is like a weird hybrid, you know, of public sector bargaining, private sector bargaining, and sort of government regulation. So where it's sort of similar to public sector bargaining is the government's involved. You know, the government approves whatever these contracts are, the sectoral bargaining agreements become basically government orders. And at least in Massachusetts and California, the government is involved in setting those terms. The Secretary of Labor, PERB, can approve or disapprove them. The government-appointed arbitrator can as well. So in that sense, you have the government sort of at the table to some degree. So that's similar to public sector bargaining. But where it's really different is public sector bargaining is the state ordering its relations vis-a-vis itself. You know, it's about what the state is going to do. Sectoral bargaining, you're talking about the state organizing relations between two private parties or multiple private parties. So it's not just how the state deals with someone, it's how different private parties deal with each other, namely the rideshare companies, Uber and Lyft, a union, whichever is designated, and then, you know, hundreds of thousands of sort of rideshare drivers. And so that sort of brings it more into the realm of, you know, a little bit of a private sector. But again, it doesn't match the private sector model because you have the government's, you know, involved in all this, and it's across the board. It's also similar in some ways to a government regulation. Instead of using, say, a rulemaking process, the traditional notice and comment, you know, for the government just to dictate how an entire industry should operate, instead of that notice and comment, you just have certain parties bargain over what the recommendations will be for the government regulator to then impose, you know, the wage sort of market order on things. So it's a very weird mix. And because of that, it raises a whole lot of legal issues because, as David said, this is sort of a novel experiment. But the thing is, there are existing laws in this country, antitrust, federal labor law, and of course, the Constitution. And it remains to be seen whether sectoral bargaining, this odd hybrid, sort of fits, you know, within the structure of American law.
Yeah, I want to stay on that point for just a second. And we've gotten some questions from the audience. And frankly, one of these questions is another one I had too. And David, I'd like to start with you, if you don't mind. The question is, you know, we've all described this as an experiment, certainly new in the United States, and perhaps, you know, for some of the reasons Bill's describing, it's new in general. Maybe there's not a direct comparison to some of these other systems in other countries. The question is, so you started out by talking about some of the reasons this might have started in rideshare. Are there other industries or sectors that you see as potentially described as targets? It's kind of a loaded term, but industries that might see legislation like this. So if you're sitting in California, what industry might you be looking at next that would share some of the features that attracted this law in the first place? Do you see any other industries as potential candidates for this kind of legislation?
Yeah, I certainly do. But, you know, I come at it. This is, I generally think collective bargaining coverage is a good thing. We want more of it. We want, I would like my, in my ideal world, most all workers would be covered by collective bargaining agreement, setting some minimum standards to ensure and improve the quality, ensure they have a good job. The places I would most like to start would be the sort of share the elements of rideshare where there's traditionally low job quality and significant barriers to traditional work site by work site unionizing. That's where I would sort of start. Although, as I said, ultimately, I think this could apply to most any industry. And before I go into sort of the other industries in the US, so the other industries, I think it might logically follow to. So in the US, we do actually have a tradition of sector bargaining, not exactly like this structure. And under the Wagner Act, it is legal to get to a bargaining that covers most of the sector. The unions have to have an incredible amount of power to force all the employers to the table. You think of the old auto industry in 50s, 60s, 70s, where they had near 100% density and can force all the big players to a pattern bargain that would effectively set the stage. So that gets at sort of ultimately, I think, a type of standard setting that covers a sector through collective bargaining could work for lots and lots of different sectors. But this kind of hybrid policy where it's sort of bargaining, but there's also some government wage setting elements. And again, to my mind, this is much better than having the governor or state elected saying, here's what we think the standard should be. You have the parties that are closest to it, the workers and the employers, at the table, if they can't directly come to an agreement, then you have the sort of this arbitration function coming in. So then now what are the most sort of industries with the low standards and what you would think of as sort of fissuring, which is where the workers work for multiple employers or there's not a clear line between the actual employer of record and the powerful company actually determining the working conditions. And I think of other industries, fast food being kind of an example where they workers work for franchises, but they might not actually have the power to raise standards. Lots of retail could fit, but the big challenge with these other industries is the legal condition that they're likely employees. So significantly limits the ability of a state to regulate, or at least they would have to come up with a different kind of model, which is not exactly this day. Then in some models, some have called it sector, but it's not exactly. The Fast Food Council, for example, in California, which is a true tripartite structure, where the government is actually at the table and it's really just a much more of a regulatory process. I get that even this rideshare still has some regulatory elements, but it's closer to bargaining.
Yeah, let's stay on that for just a beat. And I know this is not a preemption webinar, but Bill, I appreciate your perspective on this. So you mentioned, I think, in your initial statement that, you know, the drivers are independent contractors, which does create a different dynamic from the perspective of just NLRA preemption. David was referring to this a little bit. The NLRA is typically a exclusive uniform coherent system where it applies. States can't deviate or create a different bargaining system. Here, we do have a group of independent contractors. So two questions, really. One, how does that change, if at all, the preemption analysis? And two, because of the status of the workers in this case, does that create sort of a sui generis situation for a statutory system like this? Or are there other industries that are potentially open to the same kind of regulatory approach in your mind? Or are we really dealing with one of a kind?
Sure. So I think on your first question, I think imposing sectoral bargaining on rideshare drivers or independent contractors is preempted by the National Labor Relations Act, but for a different reason than it would be if if employees were subjected to sectoral bargaining. So the NLRA would definitely preempt a state from imposing sectoral bargaining on individuals who are employees because that would interfere with the federal system of collective bargaining, which is company by company. So, for example, if California declared that every auto worker in the state, if there are any left, you know, are represented by the UAW for purposes of bargaining with every auto company in the state, that would obviously interfere with the National Labor Relations Act, giving the employees the ability to choose, do they want to be unionized vis-a-vis their employer or not? And do they want to be subject to a, you know, union agreement? So applying a state, at least applying sectoral bargaining to any individuals who are employees is probably definitely a no-go under the NLRA. So that brings up the question, what about independent contractors who are, of course, exempted from the definition of employees under the NLRA? But I would say that's still preempted because the NLRA does protect independent contractors from agreements between employers and unions where the employer agrees to only do business with independent contractors who are represented by a union or subject to a union contract. The provisions of the Act are Section 80E and 8B4, secondary boycott provisions, often known as hot cargo provisions. And the funny thing that are interesting is those provisions were actually sort of enacted in a large part to protect independent drivers from the Teamsters. Because the Teamsters would try to get companies to agree to only do business with independent drivers known as owner operators who are represented by the Teamsters. That's prohibited by Section 80 and Section 84 of the Act. And so what you're really doing, California, Massachusetts, seek to do here to rideshare drivers is sort of a hot cargo agreement sort of statewide. And I believe the NLRA sort of preempts that attempt to do that. So it remains to be seen. You know, that's a new issue, but I think you have preemption there for independent contractors. And then going to your second question, I think I answered at the beginning, you know, what about individuals beyond independent contractors? And again, I think the National Labor Relations Act preempts it if the individuals sort of are employees.
Okay, got it. And I just want to take another beat on this because just to level set for the audience who just to make sure everybody's following, the NLRA applies to quote unquote statutory employees, confers certain rights on them, but it excludes a person working in the status of, or having the status of an independent contractor from the definition of employee, which is why this becomes sort of a different legal question because of the status of the workers being regulated under these laws. I'm going to stay with you for just a second, Bill, because you did reference at the end that this may be a different question. Has there been, in your knowledge, any kind of litigation over this or a similar issue that we might be able to look to as guidance for if this issue were teed up for a court, what that might look like? Has this been raised before? Is there anything we can look to?
Sure. There's been at least one case to my knowledge, or actually two related cases coming out of Seattle. So around, was it 2017, 2015, Seattle passed an ordinance to unionize rideshare drivers, not on a sectorial basis, but company by company. And so there are two lawsuits challenging it. One was by the Chamber of Commerce and Uber, alleging that this violates antitrust law, was preempted by the NLRA because it was debatable whether or not rideshare drivers were employees or contractors. So that was that case. Then a group of rideshare drivers represented by the Right to Work Foundation filed a lawsuit saying it's preempted by the National Labor Relations Act for the reason just discussed. The secondary boycott provisions of the NLRA preempt that kind of law, and that also it violates the First Amendment. And what ultimately happened is the chamber basically won on its antitrust theory at the Ninth Circuit because Seattle's really only defense to the antitrust claim was the state action immunity. And the Ninth Circuit said, you don't have it because the state never gave you authority to do this. And so because of that, Seattle folded up shop and basically rescinded its ordinance. And all the other claims more or less became moot. The driver's claims became moot. So that's what we've had so far is a court ruling on the state action immunity. But for those interested in these issues, if you go back to the case, you can read all the briefs. And a lot of these issues are briefed. Again, it wasn't sectoral bargaining, but the issue of whether or not, in this case, locality could unionize rideshare drivers was litigated in that case, or two cases.
Okay. So, I mean, we've talked about some open legal questions with these schemes, but from a policy standpoint, I want to circle back to that. And David, you've said a few times that you think, generally speaking, the thrust of this is right because you support broader coverage of bargaining rights. But just from a design standpoint, like let's say we were, creating these sectoral bargaining system in a closet. Is this the model that you would have envisioned? Like, how would you rate this from a policy standpoint? Are there things that could have been improved here? Or is this essentially the paradigm that states, from your perspective, should be looking at? How would you rate these statutes from a policy perspective?
Got it. Well, generally, I support them. But you asked my ideal, and then I'll sort of back down to sort of what's reality. In my ideal world, the sort of best kind of sectoral model, actually, in my debate partner here might actually agree with me a little bit on this. The ideal model is much more private ordering that what I think of sort of the Nordic model, the Sweden, Denmark, Norway, where they have sectoral bargaining, but is largely based on policies that support very strong unions. So unions have lots of power, and then they have lots of ability to use their economic weapons, as do employers. And then this has led to a system that covers the vast majority of workers with a good union contract, leading to high wages, low inequality, et cetera. And they don't have, minimum wage. They don't have all these kind of other things. It's really a private ordering, but they have policies that support very strong unions as well. So that leads to the private ordering. Most of the English speaking world has weaker unions for a variety of reasons. They don't have the policies that encourage them. So they end up more with this kind of hybrid model where the state is the English speaking world that supports sectoral bargaining. They tend to have this sort of hybrid model where it's a bargaining like structure, but the state is kind of a backstop to the bargaining. And so, yeah, I think this is probably in the short term where you end up for most anywhere in the US. But I want to get, this leads me to another point I wanted to make. There's a big difference here between bargaining and unionization. These policies are about bargaining primarily. No, they are ultimately a right to work policy. No one has to be a union member. No one is forced to join. The bargaining is for all the workers, whether they choose to join a union or not. And so that also should be something that I think, my debate partner would support. The Right to Work Foundation should support these kind of policies that are creating a model that is, how do we raise standards for all workers and leaves the freedom of choice totally outside the bargaining decision. They also, do create some ways for the worker, for the unions and workers to have some communications, but the choice is still purely on the worker. So anyway, that gets to your point is these are, my view, good policies, and they're also the most likely kind of structure that is going to happen in any short-term way in the U.S.
Thanks. Bill, let me give you a chance to respond to that. So there's two points, I think, on the table. One is that maybe these statutes would be improved if it was more focused on private ordering. I'll give you a chance to respond to that. And I think the other point was that the way these laws are structured perhaps give more flexibility to workers to join or not join than they might have under an NLRA scheme. Appreciate your reactions to either of those points.
Sure. So I think on the first point, ultimately, the drivers or others don't have a choice as to representation. I think every individual should have the freedom to choose individually who represents them or doesn't represent them for purposes of dealing with a private party or dealing with the government. So at the end of the day, with sectoral bargaining, you still have the government dictating that every rideshare driver in California shall be represented by the SEIU, whether they like it or not. Now, the fact it appears, at least on the face of the law, drivers won't be forced to financially support the union. That's a good thing. But I think that drivers should also have the freedom to choose whether or not they want to be represented by this union or to be subject, sort of to the union's contract. So I think, freedom goes all the way. I think taking away freedom of bargaining representative doesn't make it okay. I'm sorry. The fact you're not forcing individuals to financially support the union, which I think would be unconstitutional in this case because you have the government action here, doesn't make it okay to take away their choice as to whether any union represents them. Right now, you know, I'm sure there's many rideshare drivers who don't want any union to represent them. It's one of the reasons the thresholds in these laws are so low, which allows unions to become the exclusive representative with either 25 or 30%, or to call for an election with just 5 or 10%. So you're looking at very, very low, you know, sort of amounts of support for rideshare drivers that would allow a union to become the representative of every rideshare driver in the state for the perpetuity of the law. So I don't think taking away that choice is a good thing.
We've gotten some other questions from the audience, and I think this one is a good one. It's also a question I've had in my mind. David, circling back to you, you've talked about some of the benefits you see for workers, but there's a question about from an economic standpoint, are we raising the costs of these services in ways that could have negative externalities? And so in my mind, now I'm extrapolating on the question a little bit, but could higher costs have negative impacts on consumers? The money has to come from somewhere. Could services become more expensive? Your Uber ride to the airport, could that be more expensive? And could that in turn have potential downsides for workers in the sense of fewer opportunities, fewer consumers who are using these services? How do you think about those potential, what I'm describing as negative externalities? And does this law, could this law do anything mitigate those externalities, or is it just something that if we want to have a sectoral marketing system, people have to live with the higher costs of services? What's your perspective on that?
So, yeah, I think there's a lot of research that is analogous that can help shed light on what kind of economic effects we might have. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I generally view this as productivity enhancing. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, you are setting a higher wage across for all competitors, having a level playing field. And so then they are forced to have productivity-based competition. The other element here is you are taking the conflict about wages to a higher level, not at the individual work site, which is sort of a hard, weird thing in the rideshare world to think about, but you're also creating an opportunity for more collaborative relationships at other levels, for discussions about other works kinds of things, especially training, that the research suggests generally you get to more and better of the training, for example, under sectoral systems, because you are not having the fear that if you set up a training system and you pay a worker to get training or allow them to do it, that then you're just going to get poached by your competitor. Instead, you've created a system that supports and encourages that. The other kind of research that I think is relevant and you're alluding to is the minimum wage research, especially in the United States. There's really, you know, heavily researched and debated. And my take on that research is the reason I say it's analogous to minimum wage is you are raising the labor costs and in effect creating some sort of a minimum wage. Generally, that has seemed to improve conditions for workers. Very clear research on that. I think almost unambiguous that workers are better off. Then there's a huge research on, well, how can, you know, it then, or is it going to reduce employment? Pretty minimal, if at anything at all. And that's sort of contrary to some standard economic thought. And so how could it be if you're raising the cost of labor, you're getting minimal employment effects? Well, that's because there's also lots of other things going on. You are, the workers are consumers. You can have purchasing things. You're reducing turnover. You're getting a more stable workforce, and turnover does have costs. And the other thing, as you mentioned, yes, sometimes the costs, the costs tend to be, can be borne by customers having to pay a little bit more, and firms might make a little bit less profits. All of those are possible and have happened in the minimum wage space. In my view, those aren't bad things. Workers getting paid better, profits being trimmed possibly a little bit. We are at a point in the United States where corporate profits are near record highs. Wages are not been doing particularly well over decades. We're having a struggling with an affordability crisis. This is the kind of thing that is a more than reasonable trade-off.
Got it. Bill, I'll give you a chance to take a run at that one. And so the question on the table, as David was just explaining, is because of the, I mean, just naturally increased labor costs, which is the flip side of higher wages, representing workers or just in your experience practicing labor law for decades, I mean, do you anticipate any negative downside from an economic standpoint for workers? What's your view on how this could affect the workforce?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, given, you know, what sector you're unionizing and what terms are imposed on it. But I think naturally, you know, when you have the government sort of setting wages, you know, across the board, you're naturally, you know, leading to inefficiencies with that, as opposed to the free market setting wages and other, you know, prices in this case, because we're dealing with rideshare drivers, you know, by free market forces and competition. And of course, having the flexibility for the independent companies to evolve and figure out the best way to do things instead of being locked into sort of a one size fits all in the industry sort of union agreement that dictates all kinds of terms, which aren't just wages. A lot of other terms, you know, looking at the California bill, deactivations, things like that. And then, of course, you also have the drag of all the things the union extracts as its sort of rent seeking, you know, from this arrangement. And you can sort of really see that in the California bill with all sort of the perks that it is designed to give to unions. So, for example, if a union becomes a representative, the Uber and Lyft automatically have to start deducting dues on behalf of the union and can't stop those deductions except for by the terms of the union agreement, which usually say you can only stop deductions during every 10 or 15 days per year. Mandatory terms of the sectoral bargaining order have to include terms that compensation or fees to the union for administering benefits and things of that, labor management partnerships, which are usually just another way for companies to sort of fund sort of union activities. It also includes provisions which make it lawful for the Uber and Lyft to pay union representatives to represent drivers and to give the union access to communications, you give the union access to employer premises. So there's just a whole range of things where you can see the union, you know, sort of using this as sort of a rent seeking vehicle of, you know, to exploit and get what it wants out of this bill and this kind of laws. And so that itself becomes a drag, you know, on this entire system by giving sort of unions this privileged position in a sort of a regulatory system for an industry.
Got it. We've actually gotten a lot of good questions from the audience, so I'm going to stick with audience questions for just a moment. I'm going to rephrase this one a little bit. Some questions have come in about antitrust overlays and sort of the collective centralization of bargaining and this labor relationship. David, I'm curious for your thoughts. It's something that I've struggled with too. For years, much of the discourse was around the fissured workplace, and the problem was that we were becoming, you know, the workplaces were being broken up, and that was making it difficult to organize workers and do effective collective bargaining. But then in recent years, you've had people like Professor Posner and a few others who have talked about the real problem is monopsony, where we have employers who are too large. And I wonder, you know, something that I've thought of, and I appreciate your perspective, that by centralizing the bargaining process in this way, are we perhaps creating some risk of even greater centralization and monopsony power? Are we now flipping back to the narrative that the real problem is that employers are too small, that we have fissured workplaces? How does this policy slot into that debate? Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, so I do. And in fact, I appreciate you bringing up sort of these slightly competing versions of what is happening in to employment relationships, the sort of concentration view or the fissuring. And in my view, actually, both are happening, that the employers are becoming, or the lead firm is becoming more concentrating and more powerful. At the same time, the way the worker experiences it is becoming more and more fissured. They have less sort of contact with the employer that makes the real decision. And I actually think the rideshare is sort of a case example. Concentration, basically it's Uber and Lyft. There really isn't, that's pretty concentrated. Yeah, okay, there's a few small taxi players in some cities, but it's pretty concentrated industry. At the same time, it's fissured because they're claiming they're not employers. They're hiring all these independent contractors that they're telling exactly what to drive, how to drive, what route. Oh, they're controlling the system. in every which way. We're going to deactivate you in this touch of a button. But so that's the both concentration and fissuring, I think, are occurring at the same time. How would this, I actually think this is this kind of sectoral model is able, one of the few things able to handle both truths. It, from the worker's perspective, it gives them some ability to deal with the individual, the challenges at their work site level, but also handle the major power players in their industry to negotiate to have higher standards. So ultimately, this is actually, I think, the more accurate reflection of what's happening. And there's pretty good research from around the world that if you want workers covered by collective bargaining agreements in these kind of more challenging industries, so the sectoral model is much more effective.
Bill, I'll give you a chance with that one too. I mean, just from a, do you have any concerns as somebody who represents workers of consolidating the bargaining process and sort of locating it in a centralized area? Is there some risk to workers that you're concerned about? Are there other risks that you see from collecting this process in a central point, whether that's economic or just something that happens in the relationship between the workers? Is there an imbalance of bargaining power? What's your perspective on that?
Sure. Well, with the centralization, what you'll get is an ossification, you know, of sort of what's going on, the existing framework, as you sort of lock in the way things are. And of course, one of the great advantages of the American economy has always been its dynamism. Things change, new players come up and down. And that's part primarily because of sort of our wide open system. But if you start locking in, you know, these basically cartels, setting how entire industries run across the board, especially with the government involved, you're naturally going to get a process where it's not a dynamic one. Industries lose their efficiency, stop being dynamic, stop being competitive, you know, sort of on the world stage, that harms everybody, you know, especially workers. David mentioned earlier, you know, pattern bargaining, you know, by the UAW among the big three, you know, look what that all, you know, wrought for us. You know, the American auto industry ultimately became uncompetitive and got its, you know, was very much outcompeted, you know, by others for a very long time. So doing this across the board, I think this is going to lead to economic inefficiencies and ultimately make American companies and workers uncompetitive.
Got it.
Can I just respond really quickly to that last auto point?
Sure.
It just, I think the evidence is pretty clear that it was largely poor management that led American auto companies to their struggle and demise. The auto workers did not have any control over what to invest in, what kind of product design, any of those kind of things. Their wages at the time were lower than in certain other countries, like in Germany. They were simply bargaining for a high standard. As the unions lost their ability as the companies weakened, their competitive position fell. It was not about the union having high standards. As I said, other countries with higher standards did quite well, simply mostly about poor management. Blameless. I'm sure the unions were not blameless. I'm sure there were some dumb things they were bargaining over. I'm sure all of that. But the basic idea of high standards being incompatible and a sectoral high standard being incompatible with competition, I think, is not accurate.
I'd like to, if I can, introduce one more element. It's another question from the audience. I think this was asked as half joking, but I think it's a serious question. So when we talk about higher labor costs, often one response from the firms is higher investments in capital. And what we've all read about in the newspapers, whether it's, you know, accurate or fantasy or science fiction or not, is an increase in driverless cars. And you know, it strikes me, and I appreciate both of your thoughts on this, whether a law like this that does increase or is likely to, I don't think we can say absolutely, but is very likely to increase labor costs, could accelerate and move toward driverless cars. I mean, one of the barriers to that kind of technology is the initial cost investment. But as the cost of traditional labor rises, perhaps you find companies who are looking at this as a more serious competitive option to invest in driverless technology. I'll start with you, Bill. I mean, what's your perspective on that? Is it possible that we could see that as a response from the regulated firms, that they would put more money into this driverless technology? Is that a real possibility in your mind?
Yes. I mean, I think sort of the analogy to taxis sort of shows vis-a-vis Uber. There you had a very regulated industry, which, you know, failed to really evolve for a long time. And then somebody came in that was new. It wasn't a taxi. It was Uber and Lyft, and really supplanted them because they weren't covered by all the same sort of layers of regulation that the taxis companies were sort of dealing with. You can see that if Uber and Lyft are subject to the sort of the same, you know, lock them in so they can't really evolve kind of system, naturally that will lead to others who are outside of that system, who aren't TNCs within the meetings of these laws coming in. So, for example, companies like Waymo that don't have drivers, or other companies that choose to do autonomous vehicles, and then companies that are sort of stuck under, you know, this sectoral bargaining, you know, kind of system, are unable to compete and evolve, you know, to deal with new entries that are under the sector. And then sort of follow up another sort of example of that where you can see the inefficiencies is, you know, David alluded earlier to sometimes under the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, you have multi-employer bargaining. Sometimes construction industry is done voluntarily. It's not compelled. But where you see instances of that, you see a lot of inefficiencies. Take the longshoremen and our ports. That's basically sectoral bargaining on each port just because of the way things are set up. And America's ports, as a result, are some of the most inefficient in the world. You know, as a result of some of the things that those agreements and the longshoremen sort of locked into place, fighting against sort of any kind of evolution of technology. Now, they've been able to get away with that because there's only so many ports in the country. But if you do that to an industry that can be competed against, it's ultimately not going to work out well in the long term as new market entries, new technologies supplant the firm that's sort of locked into the sectoral bargaining system.
David, I'll let you take a run at that one too. You want to bring us home with
sure. Robotaxis are coming no matter what happens with sectoral bargaining. That is just the industry is moving that way. That's very clear. I think any effect sectoral bargaining might have would be very marginal to slightly encourage it, possibly because you got higher labor costs. But they're coming. And so that actually is why this is such an important experiment, because real question of whether these jobs will be around in 10 years. But in the meantime, can we make them good? Can the policy affect them fast enough to actually create decent jobs out of this? And does that create a model that we think about in other places? So to me, the robo-taxi sort of debate is really about how we think about jobs that have some threat from technology, which at some level is most all jobs now. And can we make them good while they still exist? And can we give the workers some platform to think about what their next place is? Possibly they'll be even bargaining about their next jobs, getting training for those. And that is possible in this model. And it's in the current model where they have nothing, there isn't. And so that's sort of actually where I would just leave it is, I can't imagine the question really is about whether you want and you think rideshare driving or most other jobs should be able to be really poorly paid, really exploitable, or whether we want to think about creating a better model. And this is one of the very few models that I can think of that has real potential to improve job quality in these kind of difficult sectors.
Well, I think we are almost at the hour, so we're probably going to have to leave it there. This was a fantastic discussion. I really do want to thank our two panelists for offering some really deep knowledge on this subject. I learned a lot today. I hope our audience learned something too. So thank you both very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Viralist Society, thank you so much to Mr. Madlin and to Mr. Messenger for speaking with us today, and to Mr. McDonald for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, bedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, And to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.